Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Later on in this hour, we're going to talk about fair housing and how the Bay Area remains deeply segregated despite its reputation as a progressive beacon. We're also going to hear from author Matt Kepnes on how to see the world on just $75 a day. But first, we're going to celebrate a mighty comeback for a small creature. Rare butterflies are fluttering back into San Francisco's Presidio. For the second year in a row, scientists have released dozens of silvery blue butterflies into the park, a symbolic effort to restore a species that vanished from this land nearly a century ago. The project is part of a larger movement to rewild the Presidio Park and help native ecosystems make a comeback. Joining us now is Lou Stringer, Associate Director of Natural Resources at the Presidio Trust. He's been working to restore the park's natural habitat for more than 30 years. So Lou, welcome to State of the Bay.
Hi, glad to be here.
So Lou, let's start with the silvery blue butterfly. Can you tell us a bit about this insect, what its history is, and why it was important to bring this insect back into the Presidio?
Absolutely. And I'll clarify from your intro, it's a little bit different than was stated, but the silvery blue butterfly is a stand-in for a butterfly that went extinct in the 1940s, which was called the Xerxes blue butterfly. The Xerxes blue was the first butterfly in North America to go extinct due to human development and habitat loss. Okay. And so several years ago, we worked with out of inspiration with from the Xerxes Society, the preeminent insect conservation organization in the US, who had Robert Michael Pyle, who is their president, founder, had created a vision, and he'd seen the work of habitat restoration that had been happening in the Presidio. And he imagined this idea of resurrecting the lost Xerxes blue. And so we started a process to determine, through looking at the genome of the extinct Xerxes, which was in the collection at Cal Academy of Sciences in San Francisco, by taking little leg segments and evaluating their DNA, our partners at the California Academy of Sciences, Darrell Kappen, the scientist there, mapped the genome of the Xerxes blue. And what he found was that Xerxes blue was very closely aligned with the genome of this more broadly existing silvery blue butterfly. So that Xerxes blue fit right in there, but it was truly distinct. Not only did it look different, genomically it was different. So whether it was a distinct species, we're not totally sure, but it was clearly distinct from the silvery blue. So bringing back an organism, the silvery blue, is what we have been doing. It's a more broadly widespread species. And by bringing it back to San Francisco, and particularly in the Presidio, we are setting it off back on a evolutionary path in the habitat that has been restored.
Well, I appreciate you clarifying that this is a closely related, similar species, but we've lost the original Xerxes blue, as you described. Can you just maybe paint a picture of what the butterfly looks like for our listeners who probably haven't seen one before?
Yeah, it's a small blue butterfly, about the size of a nickel, and it has a beautiful iridescent blue surface. And on the wings, when they're folded up, it's kind of gray with a series of kind of darkish markings on the underside of the wing.
And as we think about introducing this new species here, or maybe similar to the old species, what caused the original species to go extinct? And how do we know that the same thing isn't going to happen now to this reintroduced species?
Back in the Victorian era and beyond, butterfly collection was a big thing. There were people collecting butterflies from all over the world and sharing them. And the Xerxes, the now extinct butterfly, was one of these great items. It was a rare species, endemic to San Francisco, didn't live anywhere else. And it was a beautiful butterfly. And so people were collecting it and sharing them all over the place as specimens. And that was kind of part of the Victorian era. But then during that same period, we saw the transformation of basically the wild San Francisco that suddenly and slowly urbanized so that all of its habitat was pushed away. And specifically, most butterfly species have a very distinct evolutionary relationship with a very specific plant species. And so this particular Xerxes blue, as well as the silvery blue, were a dune species. And they had a plant called deerweed that they laid their eggs on, and the babies, the larvae, would feed on exclusively on that plant. And so as the city migrated into the Great Sand Waste, as it was called, the Richmond and the Sunset Districts, those parcels of former sand dune became smaller and smaller. And the last remnants of that former existing dune landscape, which was the fourth largest dune system in California, was pushed into the Presidio, the last bit of it. And so by the time 1940 rolled around, much of that remaining habitat was being lost through army activities and the transformation of the Presidio.
We're speaking with Lou Stringer, Associate Director of Natural Resources at the Presidio Trust, here on State of the Bay on KALW. And we're talking about the reintroduction of the silvery blue butterfly into the Presidio. And Lou, what is it going to take then to make sure that this species that you're introducing is going to be able to thrive? Is it a matter of making sure that the plant that you just described is doing well too? What is it going to take to make the ecosystem hospitable for reintroducing the species?
Well, ever since the Presidio became a national park from an former army base in the middle 1990s, the work of habitat restoration as a national park has been a priority for the Presidio. So we've restored several hundred acres of habitat that the Army had transformed through the period that the Army was there. So now we have 100 more acres of sand dunes than used to be there. We have riparian communities. We have oak woodlands. We have serpentine grasslands. And with the return of this habitat and those host plants, we as a forever park will continue to maintain and restore those landscapes so that that butterfly has the ability to persist in that location. And science tells us that the scale and size of this particular parcel is likely to support that butterfly in the long term. So by having habitat, having the stewardship, the tending of that habitat that's so crucial for our urban biodiversity hotspots, we believe that if we're successful, and we're not totally sure yet that our reintroduction is going to be successful, but we're going to continue to try this next year. This is the second year we've reintroduced them. And then one more year, we'll bring more butterflies in. And after 3 years, we hope to have a sizable enough population that they can reproduce and be present without having to intervene on their behalf going forward.
And Lou, this is such a remarkable example of rewilding, as I talked about introducing this segment. And I wanted to get your thoughts on the role of human intervention in restoring species and rebuilding ecosystems like what's happening in the Presidio. What do you think is the value of doing this kind of rewilding work?
Value is that we're in the middle of this biodiversity crisis. Habitat loss, the loss of species, is accelerating. And there is a countervailing trend that is starting to build momentum as well. And that is this decade of ecosystem restoration that the UN has identified that we are in. And so even small parcels like the Presidio hold extraordinary and sometimes unique biodiversity. Urban areas throughout the world are parcels of exceptional biodiversity that happens to be hanging on in the little cracks of wildlands that persist in our cities. And so San Francisco is a great example of that, and Presidio in particular, where we, through the act of stewardship, can expand those little remnant pieces. And by bringing back the foundation of that ecosystem, which are our plant communities, can then consider bringing in organisms that couldn't get across those urban streets, that could live there and thrive if they were brought back. So by rewilding, we're intentionally bringing animals in particular there that can't get there on their own, but used to call those places home. And by continuing the act of stewarding these places, that is bringing volunteers and staff out to tend these landscapes, we believe that we have the ability to counter the trend of the loss of habitats and as well as species.
And Lou, you talked a bit about just the transformations that the Presidio has undergone, going from military base now to, you know, essentially a place of rewilding. Can you comment on what you've observed in your years there about how people's relationship to that land has changed with those transformations, how you've noticed visitors changing and how they relate and utilize the Presidio? And I suppose as a related question, our producer, Katie, has told me she spends a lot of time walking in the Presidio and has noticed more and more birders, for example. So just wanted to see if you could just comment on how you've observed people changing and how they use and relate to the Presidio.
Absolutely. When I first started working in the Presidio in the late 1990s, I was in charge as the revegetation coordinator of the Crissy Field project. And as part of that project, there used to be banners up and down the streets of San Francisco that said, "Help grow Crissy Field," which was a campaign by the organization, the Golden Gate National Parks Conservancy, to bring in and engage as many people in the act of restoring that landscape. So Crissy Field, as people may remember, was a filled in tidal wetland that was basically a brownfield by the late 1990s, the mid 1990s. And the first big restoration project that happened there was the restoration of Crissy Field dunes and salt marsh. And so as part of that, we got literally thousands of people that came out to pull weeds and plant plants, collect seeds that were grown to be outplanted back there. So the act of bringing in people to help us with this work has greatly contributed to that feeling of place, that you can make a positive human impact by coming out and participating in the work. So that has touched literally thousands of people. The Presidio itself is one of the biggest draws for volunteers in the country, in the national park system, partly because of where we are. We're here in San Francisco and people care about this place and want to participate in making it better. So that's one way that's made a difference. But since people were able to move back to the Presidio and actually live there, we've raised a generation of kids that have been able to explore this urban oasis. And so many of them have become master birders themselves. We've had kids who grew up renting houses in the Presidio, and in their backyard was one of the great spots on the Pacific Flyway to see the great diversity of birds that inhabit this landscape. And so kids who are, you know, we have this massive nature deficit disorder for kids, but that isn't the case in the Presidio, where we've had so many kids that have grown up looking at birds, being trained by some of the greatest birders in the world that live here in San Francisco, coming out and observing these places. Yeah. So
It's such a wonderful resource, a real gem within a gem of a city in San Francisco. And we're basically out of time, Lou, but I just wanted to ask you just very briefly, for visitors who want to see this introduced blue butterfly, are they able to do so? And if so, where in the park?
These butterflies fly for a short period before they lay their eggs and they die. But in the next few weeks, one of the great places you can see them is in the Lobos Creek Valley, where the boardwalk winds through the restored dunes there.
All right. So you heard it here. Well, maybe not first, but you heard it here, where to check out these beautiful butterflies being reintroduced. Lou Stringer, Associate Director of Natural Resources at the Presidio Trust. Thank you so much for talking to us about the Presidio and this effort to bring those butterflies back. And I hope to catch one out there myself. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And by the way, I don't want to catch one. I just want to catch sight of one. I just want to clarify. Right. I'm here to kidnap the butterflies. Thank you, Lou. And coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk about an altogether different kind of landscape. We're going to be joined by Stephen Menendian from UC Berkeley's Other and Belonging Institute about fair housing and why the Bay Area, despite its reputation for progressive policies, remains deeply segregated. Stay with us.
On the next Throughline from NPR.
The majority of women, you know, in the history, the last 400 or 500 years of capitalism, have been engaged primarily in activities that have not been recognized as work.
The price we ask mothers to pay and how we value them in return.
And that would be Throughline. Tomorrow afternoon at 5 o'clock, here on 91.7 FM, KALW.
Tune in to Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. We'll hear about folk tales and why they matter.
You heard true stories, family stories, ghost stories. I mean, African Americans, when we first came to America, we had to be totally oral.
The duty of keeping the stories alive. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. While the Bay Area is among the most diverse in the country, it's also among the most racially segregated. And that segregation didn't happen by accident. From redlining to exclusionary zoning, our neighborhoods in the Bay have long been shaped by policies that separate people by race and class. Joining us now is Stephen Menendian, Assistant Director and Director of Research at the Othering and Belonging Institute at UC Berkeley. The Othering and Belonging Institute brings together researchers, organizers, stakeholders, and policymakers to identify and eliminate the barriers to an inclusive, just, and sustainable society. Stephen's primary areas of expertise are structural racism, civil rights, and fair housing. He's written books on these topics and presented his work around the country, and he's joining us tonight to talk about fair housing and segregation in the Bay Area and help us understand why this is happening and what we can do about it. So, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us on State of the Bay.
Thank you for having me, Ethan.
So tonight we're talking about fair housing, which I understand is different from an issue that grabs headlines in the Bay Area, which is affordable housing. Can you describe or define exactly what fair housing means and how you define it differently from affordable housing or housing affordability, as others might use those terms?
Great question. You know, housing is such an prominent and important issue, not just in the country, but in the Bay and in California. And unfortunately, when we talk about housing, people have very different ideas of the problem in mind. So when journalists use the term affordable housing, they often use it in a conflated way with housing affordability. So affordable housing is really housing that is dedicated or designed for people who are low income or very low income. Housing affordability refers to the median cost of housing. So think about, what is the ordinary home in your region or state cost? You're really talking about two completely different things. Housing affordability is really about the middle class, and affordable housing is really about the poor, the working poor, and the very poor. And those are altogether different from fair housing. Fair housing is really principally about identity, historically race, racial segregation, racial integration, and then more recently about particular groups like the elderly and seniors, or family, what's called familial status, which would be generally, if you are a parent who has small children, you don't want landlords discriminating against families with small children. And so there are familial status protections, and of course, people with disabilities and other groups. But fair housing is really about identity, and affordable housing and housing affordability is really about class and economics.
Well, I appreciate that explanation. And I know the term fair housing has been politically charged. Can you talk about its origin and what the controversy around it has been?
Yeah, fair housing is one of those issues that has, you know, waxed and waned over the decades, but it remains a really persistent problem. And the origin of the term is actually comes largely from California. In the 1950s, there were, among the civil rights movements, a movement called the Open Housing Movement. And this was a movement mostly led by civil rights activists and leaders to try and get neighborhoods that had been recently or continued to be exclusionary, particularly on the basis of race, to simply open up their neighborhoods, right? So if you had restricted covenants that prohibited, you know, non-Christians or non-white people from getting access to the neighborhood, an open housing ordinance would be a local municipal ordinance that would prohibit discrimination in the sale, lease, rental, you know, so forth of a home. And Berkeley, for example, in early 1963, adopted an open housing ordinance. And then a few months later, there was a ballot initiative that promptly overturned that. And the same thing happened at the state level with the Rumsford Fair Housing Act, where Proposition 14, 1964, the state electorate overturned that law. And the term fair housing emerges from these battles. So, you know, think about busing, right? Busing was such a heated issue in the 70s and 80s. In this country. And on one side, you had people saying this is forced busing, forced. And the exact same thing was happening in the housing context, where opponents of these open housing ordinances would call them forced housing. You're, how dare you force me to sell to these people I don't like or don't want to rent to? And the counter strategy to that was to rebrand open housing as fair housing. And I'd say it was pretty successful because from the early 1960s on, you had 25 states adopt fair housing laws. And then in 1968, you had, of course, the federal government adopt the 1968 Fair Housing Act in the wake of MLK's assassination.
And that was, of course, a landmark federal law invalidating a lot of restrictive covenants that properties all around the Bay Area still have on their titles, on their deeds, and was really a landmark civil rights law. And I know your institute just released some data on the Bay Area's racial makeup and the state of racial segregation here in our region. Can you talk about what you found and how racial segregation has changed over the years in the Bay?
Certainly. The Bay Area, as you said, is unique, almost uniquely diverse. You have such an incredible range of not just representation, but really the mix is incredibly balanced in some ways. Particularly cities like Oakland, which have, you know, have gone gentrification and rapid change. The Bay Area is still an amazingly diverse place. So one of the things I wanted to do was just look at the most recent data. We, of course, have the 2020 decennial census data, which was released in 2021, in late 2021, but just more recently than that is a subset sampling that the census does called the American Community Survey. And they do a rolling five-year estimate that was released just a couple of months ago. And I wanted to take a look at that. Basically, the Bay Area, in the nine county region, is about 35.5% white, 27-28% Asian, almost 25% Latino, Latinx, about 5.5% Black, and then 6.5% other. So right now, there is no racial majority. If you think about the Bay Area, it is plurality white, but the Asian demographic is growing rapidly. And it's hard to make projections on a trajectory, but I suspect that probably by 2040, 2045, maybe even as late as 2050, we will be a plurality Asian region, assuming that these racial categories remain stable, because Asian, like all these identity groups, are extremely heterogeneous, right? You're talking about South Asian, Asian, East Asian, Indian, Filipino, and so on and so forth. But the Bay Area is nonetheless quite diverse in that regard. Unfortunately, that diversity, you know, diversity is certainly a very important thing, right? And places that are diverse is part of the dynamism of the Bay Area. You know, going back to the Silk Road, places where East meets West, places that are diverse like the Bay Area are where brilliant ideas emerge, where connections are made, and you know, you get incredible diversity of thought and investment. And so that's a great asset. But places that are diverse also have greater potential for segregation. And segregation is, of course, harmful because it separates people, not just from each other, but from opportunity, from life enhancing and vitalizing resources. And so children who grow up in segregated and neighborhoods of concentrated poverty really have much worse life chances than children who get to grow up in more integrated environments. And we see that in the data. And so the big picture story here is that the Bay Area has incredible diversity, but that diversity is just fuel for segregation because of our historical policies and contemporary policies. So just to kind of put it in perspective, you know, despite our progressive reputation, the Bay Area is in the top 20 most segregated regions and cities. So just to give you a couple specific examples, Oakland, which I mentioned is incredibly diverse, is ranked 16th in our list of most segregated cities in the entire country, just behind Atlanta and one notch above Memphis. The San Francisco, Oakland, Fremont metropolitan area is ranked 22nd of the almost 200 metropolitan regions in our list, most segregated. So it's not at the top, it's not in Chicago, New York, Milwaukee, but it's certainly in a very uncomfortable place. And we'll drill down more into this, but some of the particular areas of the Bay Area are getting really, really segregated. And in our data, what we found, perhaps surprisingly, is the most segregated county of the 9-county Bay Area is Marin. And it's by a long shot. And Marin continues to really increase its level of segregation decade after decade.
Yeah, so much for us to talk about with this data. I just want to let listeners know, if you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're talking to Stephen Menendian about racial segregation in the Bay Area. Stephen is Assistant Director and Director of Research at the Othering and Belonging Institute at UC Berkeley, and they have new data out, as you were just hearing, about racial segregation in the Bay Area, and we want to hear from you. We're going to go ahead and open the phone lines. Have you seen signs of segregation or integration in your own neighborhood? What do you think it would take to truly create inclusive communities in the San Francisco Bay Area? The number to call to join this conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We would love to hear your thoughts or your questions that you might have for Stephen on the data that they're finding. You can also email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. And again, that's 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Well, Stephen, you mentioned broadly where our demographics are right now, where they're likely to go, as well as some of the standout in terms of segregation areas around the Bay. And I'm wondering if you could talk about some of the changes that you might have noted in the data over time. So you're talking about, for example, there might be an Asian plurality in the Bay Area, but what about some of these local communities? What kind of changes have you seen locally with racial segregation, racial demographic makeup?
Well, particularly in the East Bay, there's been a rapid change over the last really 2.5 decades. Places like Union City, Dublin, these are very segregated places, but they really demographically changed. And so have places like Richmond, frankly. You know, East Palo Alto is one of the most segregated cities in the region, but you've seen tremendous change from really predominantly Black communities to Latino communities. Same in Richmond. I don't think Richmond might be there. I don't have the data in front of me, but you see a lot of change. And you know, part of it is, again, just continuing on a certain trajectory. Part of it is more rapid than that. So, you know, just a couple of interesting points. You know, the Bay Area was 9% Black in 1980. And as I mentioned, now it's under 5.5% Black. And also the Black population in the Bay Area peaked in absolute terms in 1990 at over 500,000. Now it's down closer to 400,000. So we've seen declines, really, you know, I hate to use the word excess, but we've seen rapid declines both in relative terms and absolute terms in the Bay Area's Black population. And then we've seen a correspondingly just enormous rise, again, in the Asian and Latino population. Just to give you some figures on Asian population, in 1980, the Asian population of the Bay Area was about 9% of the Bay Area and about 450,000. In 2010 alone, it was already 24% of the population, it almost 1.7 million people. So that's just, I mean, that's just, you know, the beginning of a roller coaster, just extremely high trajectory.
You mentioned how diverse the Asian population is. Are there particular groups within that Asian demographic that are responsible for that increase?
So the census changes almost every decennial census changes the categories. It's hard to disaggregate that, and there have been efforts at the state level to try to do that. Professor Michael Omi has been part of an effort. I don't have great disaggregated data in these racial groups, and in fact, before 1980, it's almost impossible to get. But there is tremendous just heterogeneity, right? The Bay Area has had, as many listeners will know, a really longstanding Chinese historical footprint, right? That's the Chinatowns, you know, going to the 19th century, and then in the 20th century, there have been, of course, a quite separate and quite equally horrifying experience for Japanese Americans with the Japanese internment, and then the displacement of Japanese people from neighborhoods like the Fillmore, which then became Black neighborhoods. And so just different experiences, but really a lot of this change begins with the Immigration and Naturalization Act of 1965 that changes how people can become naturalized from a very restrictive regime to one that's much more open and fluid. And the Bay Area has certainly benefited and changed from that.
We have an email question in. Jordan in North Berkeley writes, what explains the loss of the Black population in the San Francisco Bay Area? Where is that population relocating to?
So it's interesting, you know, there's so much complexity and nuance here. So there have been a lot of demographic shifts of the Black population. In the 90s and 2000s, a lot of Black families moved from places like Oakland and San Francisco into East Contra Costa County, places like Antioch and Pittsburgh. But as you point out, it's been an absolute loss. What we have seen is a lot of people have been displaced from the Bay Area, particularly young people. Now, there are a number of people who have been able to hang on because they bought their homes in the night. People of the Great Migration who moved here in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, they maybe bought their home in 1965 or 1972, and because of Prop 13 have been able to afford the taxes or just otherwise been able to stay. But their children and grandchildren have had a much more difficult time remaining here. And a lot of the policies, you know, Berkeley pioneered single family only zoning for neighborhoods at the turn of the 20th century as a way to kind of create a particular kind of neighborhood. And those policies, as many people know, have contributed to the housing affordability crisis and the affordable housing crisis, both crises, as well as the fair housing crisis. And so where those people are going, many of them, there's been a tremendous increase in the number of Black people returning from the West and the North to the South. They're going to places like Houston, Austin, Atlanta, Phoenix. Those are some of the hotspots, but places like that are some of the hubs that are drawing Black Californians and other Black Northerners.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the question. And another topic, we've talked about the most segregated parts of the Bay Area. You've mentioned some of the most segregated parts, Marin County in particular. Are there any models of integration, you know, bright spots for diversity and inclusion that your data has surfaced?
Yeah, it's hard to call them models because in some of these cases, the places are so small, the population is so small, it's hard to know whether they can actually serve as a model. But we did find, despite a lot of segregation, there are actually six cities in the Bay Area. And I should mention, part of the reason that the Bay Area is so segregated is because it's so fragmented, right? You have 101 municipal jurisdictions plus the 9 counties. So you have 110 jurisdictions that have their own policies, and that fragmentation leads to stratification. So the six cities that we identified out of that 101 that are actually integrated, not just moderately segregated, but actually integrated, are Ronette Park, Windsor, Petaluma, Pinole, Cloverdale, and I might mispronounce this, Suisun City.
Suisun City,
these are, yeah, these are you know, the largest city in that group is Petaluma at about 62,000, and Roanoke Park is about 52,000. But these places are not just diverse, they're actually integrated.
So a few bright spots, but as you say, we have some questions around the data there. I have another email comment in from Raphael in San Francisco, who writes, my family has lived in the Mission for generations, but we've seen so many longtime Latino residents pushed out. How is that affecting integration in the city?
It's such a common story. One of the problems is that displacement may look like integration in the short term, but it's ultimately part of a process that just leads to a new form of segregation. So ultimately what it does is you have just a resorting of people into a new segregated pattern. Part of the challenge to integration is finding ways to be able to keep people not fixed in place. We want people to have choice and agency and dynamism, but people who want to stay in neighborhoods to be able to afford those neighborhoods and not be displaced.
So if you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we'd love to have you join the conversation. We're speaking about racial segregation in the Bay Area, joined by Stephen Menendian, Assistant Director and Director of Research at the Othering and Belonging Institute at UC Berkeley, with new data about patterns of racial segregation in the Bay Area. And if you have a question for Stephen about how your neighborhood might compare to others in terms of inclusivity or lack thereof, the number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or email your question or comment to stateofthebay@kalw.org. Stephen, we've got about 6 or 7 minutes left here, and I do want to make sure we have time to talk about the solutions to this problem of lack of integration, lack of inclusivity, really throughout the Bay Area, as you've been discussing. What are some of the things that you would like to see done to try to reverse these trends and make sure we have truly fair housing for more people in the Bay Area?
Right. Well, one of the things we have to do is first recognize that fair housing and segregation is a different problem than affordable housing. Even if we solve the affordable housing crisis and homelessness and the housing affordability crisis, we may actually have done very little to solve the fair housing problem. And there's different reasons for that. One reason is because part of the problem is the racial wealth gap that you have in California and in the Bay Area, huge disparities in terms of home ownership rates by race. California lags the country in terms of overall rates of home ownership. Nationally, about 62% of households own their own home. In California, it's much closer to 50%. And for Black families, it's in the 20s, and if we're lucky, the 30s. So the Bay Area and California just lag in overall rates of home ownership. And it's not to say that everyone should own their home, but housing affordability contributes to the inability to purchase a home. So that's part of the problem. And so we do need to look at how we can make housing less expensive. And, you know, there's different ways to do that. One, of course, is subsidized housing. But it's not just about subsidized housing. It's where we place subsidized housing. This is really the key. When you look at LIHTC, the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program, which is one of the largest affordable housing programs in the country, the state of California 6 or 7 years ago was actually doing much worse than it is now. It was putting most of that housing into poor and segregated neighborhoods. Now there's a policy to make more of that housing available in higher opportunity neighborhoods to facilitate integration. And that policy is beginning to work. But we need to do that with other housing programs, not just LIHTC, so that we're not just putting, again, the poorest, most vulnerable people in the most disadvantaged neighborhoods. And that just tends to be what happens. You look at the fights in San Francisco over, you know, homeless shelters and homeless relocation facilities. So we need to do much more, not just to build housing, but to think about where to put it. You know, families with children should really be in neighborhoods that have good schools, right? It's not just about housing. It's also about the overall environment. And that has to be part of the conversation. There are other things, but I think those are some of the keys.
Well, and so much of this seems to me to boil down to zoning, which is fundamentally the land use policies that govern what can be built where. And there have been some efforts at the state level to try to change the zoning, particularly in high income areas that have access to transit, like BART stations, to basically require those cities to allow more multifamily housing. And yet at the same time, you have groups that are committed to equity and affordable housing that are opposed to some of those measures.
That's right.
So what do you make of that debate and how important it would be for the state to have to intervene to make any of these changes really happen?
Well, you're wading into one of the hottest hot button issues in the state for the last 5 years or so. There were bills that would have upzoned near transit. And those bills famously or infamously were SB 829 and SB 50. And they were unsuccessful. They were not adopted into law. And I completely agree with you. I think that the exclusionary zoning problem is a huge problem. And we should credit cities like Berkeley and places like Sacramento that are trying to take this on. The problem with that is that this cannot be solved in a jurisdiction by jurisdiction way. Again, even if Berkeley were to completely solve this problem and open up its neighborhoods, that would be one city out of 101. So it has to be done at the regional and really the state level. We did an analysis of single family only zoning in California as part of our California Zoning Atlas research. And we found that 95.8% of total residential land in California is zoned single family only, which means that basically only about 4% of residential land in the whole state allows multifamily units, denser housing options. We just cannot solve this problem, even with duplexes. We need what's called the missing middle. We need to build diverse forms of housing for diverse families and diversity writ large.
Well, we just have about a minute or two left. And so I wanted to ask on behalf of any listeners who are tuning in and would like to be a part of the solution, what do you recommend to people who want to try to address these types of racial segregation dynamics in the Bay Area, perhaps in their communities? What do you recommend?
Well, I think one thing we just need to do is again, be conscious of the difference between affordable housing and fair housing. There are all sorts of fair housing organizations at the regional level, at the state level, in different counties that you can join or learn about. Richard Rothstein has created an organization in the wake of his book, The Color of Law. And he's also written a phenomenal sequel to it that attempts to try and help local people solve this problem. And he has a number of interesting models, which I don't have time to delve into, where people can actually try to facilitate greater integration. But part of it is we just have to be conscious of it. We can't keep ignoring this problem and remain indifferent to it. And only then can we actually begin to solve it.
And Stephen, are there any examples from around the country or perhaps other regions in the state that are a template of what a successful type of integration approach could look like?
Richard writes about several examples. There's a suburb in, I think it's called Shaker Heights in Ohio, that in the 1980s actually had a very deliberate and well-designed integration plan. And there's also a place in Chicago that was working on this. There are places where you can do this. And there are solutions, policies that can be, you know, levers that can be pulled to try and facilitate it. There are limits, parameters on law. You can't do a lot of things in a race-specific way. But if your goal really is to facilitate integration, it can be done by looking at these particular models.
So Shaker Heights in Cleveland, I believe it is, correct?
Yeah, I believe it's a suburb of Cleveland, yeah.
Yeah, well, thank you. First of all, for that example, but also just for doing the work that you're doing to educate people about the patterns of racial segregation in the San Francisco Bay Area and for coming on State of the Bay tonight to talk about this work. So informative. Stephen Menendian, Assistant Director and Director of Research at UC Berkeley's Othering and Belonging Institute. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise, Stephen.
Wonderful to be with you, Ethan.
And coming up after this break, our very own producer, Ann Harper, talks to Matt Kepnes, author of How to Travel the World on $70 a Day. So stay with us.
On Your Call, we talk about current events, politics, arts, and the media. We're always thinking about ways people can get involved and make change. And we want your knowledge and experience in the mix. I'm Rose Aguilar. Join the conversation on Your Call weekdays at 10 a.m. on KALW. Or make your voice heard anytime. Email us, yourcall@kalw.org, or tweet at Your Call Radio.
Next time you're browsing the web, click on over to KALW.org for the latest in local news and culture, updates from our music hosts, and unique features you can only hear from the talented crew at KALW Public Media. Visit KALW.org.
Hi, I'm Hanat Baba, host of Cross Currents, and I have a new podcast out, Folk Tales from Sudan, a collection of the stories I grew up with. Teaching children about culture is so important right now. Join me this May as I tell Folk Tales from Sudan live at your local branch of the Oakland Public Library. And I'll be accompanied by a live musician. For all the details, go to kalw.org/events, and I hope to see you.
Sometimes we all need someone to talk to during emotionally difficult times. Our trained mental health crisis counselors are here 24/7 if you or a loved one needs support. Call the San Mateo County Crisis Line anytime at 650-579-0350.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ann Harper, and tonight we're talking about something we all dream about, quitting our jobs, packing a bag, and traveling the world. And what if I told you could do this on a budget? Our guest today is Matt Kettness, also known as Nomadic Matt. His best-selling book is called How to Travel the World on $75 a Day, and he has a new edition out. Matt, welcome to State of the Bay.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's start at the beginning. What made you want to give up the 9-to-5 and hit the road so many years ago?
When I was in Thailand in 2005, I met a bunch of backpackers, and I got really jealous of how long they were traveling for. At the time, I was 24, and I was working in healthcare, and I was also doing a graduate degree. So I thought, you know what, I will quit my job, finish the degree, and then go away for a year and get the travel bug out of my system. And I never got the travel bug out of my system.
Well, your book is full of very practical advice, hacking points, budget airlines. What are the travel habits that give people the most bang for the buck, would you say, when you're trying to travel on a budget?
Yeah, the biggest thing you can do is also the easiest. It's just be flexible. There are deals happening all the time, all around the world. So if you're a little bit flexible on when you can go or where you can go, you're going to encounter lots and lots of deals. But if you are dead set on going to Italy in July when everybody else is going to Italy, you lose a lot of your ability to save money.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people think that budget travel means sleeping in train stations or living off of instant noodles. What's the biggest myth about traveling on the cheap that you're constantly busting?
Oh, there's so many. For me, it's just about knowing where the resources are to travel like you live. Every day when you're home, you're looking for deals and you're not spending a lot of money. You're grocery shopping, et cetera, et cetera. That kind of thing happens anywhere else in the world. So it's really about knowing how to take that mentality and apply it locally. And so one of the things people can do is just walk into a tourist office. We think of tourist offices as these places filled with cheesy attractions, but really they're an invaluable resource that's staffed with locals who can tell you when the museums are free, what festivals or happenings are going on in the city, and where they go after work to get drinks and food that are not filled with tourists.
You first wrote this book over a decade ago, and since then we've had a pandemic. Airfare has been up and down and up again. Is it still possible in 2025 to travel the world for the cost of dinner in San Francisco?
Yes, it is. Some places are a little easier than others, but at the end of the day, you know, it's again about knowing the strategies to find the deals. There are airline deals happening all the time. If you're flexible and you're willing to just maybe go a little off season or on the shoulder season, or maybe just go next week. At the start of this, you talked about points, and points are an invaluable way to lower your travel costs, whether it's through accommodation or flights. So as long as you can pay your credit card off fully each month, there's no reason not to have one that's earning you points.
And where do you find the cheapest airfares?
I love three websites, google.com/flights, so Google Flights, Skyscanner, and Momondo. Those three are really the best starting points to get a sense of how much things cost. For flexibility, the two newsletters I like are Thrifty Traveler and Going.
All right, great. And what about for those of us who need a decent mattress when we sleep? Is there a version of budget travel that works for people who maybe are less likely to sleep in a dorm full of young people?
Well, I don't like sleeping in a dorm full of young people either. I love a good mattress. So I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
Other options are Airbnb rooms. So if you don't want to rent a whole place, you can rent someone's guest room. The website Home Exchange, maybe you can swap homes with somebody else. And then there's another service called Rakuten, R-A-K-U-T-E-N. And it's a coupon website, and oftentimes we'll have 10% off a website like Booking or Expedia. So that's another way to reduce how much you spend.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you've been on the road for years. What's the most unexpected thing you've had to pack?
I can't think of anything. Everything feels so normal. Like, oh, I'm going hiking. Let's get hiking shoes. I'm going safarying. I guess I need malaria pills. I don't find anything that's like unusual.
Okay.
But I think one thing people underestimate packing is a good flashlight. It's always nice to just have a little flashlight. You never know when it's going to come in handy.
Mm-hmm. Have you found inexpensive safaris?
Yeah, for safaris, the best way to get an affordable safari, there's two things you can do. One, you look for a last-minute deal. You know, hey, we're leaving in 2 weeks, because nobody wants to go on an empty safari. Mm-hmm. Or you go to the country that you want a safari in, you book locally. Now, a lot of people don't like booking locally. They tend to go with bigger operators because it's such an investment that... Mm-hmm. You want to know the dates before you go, right? Because if you land in Cape Town, maybe the next safari that's inexpensive leaves 4 days, but you only have seven, right? Mm-hmm. So, but same thing with Antarctica trips or hiking Machu Picchu. Buying those large experiences locally rather than booking in advance will save you a lot of money.
And what do you think the ideal length of time to go on safari is? I've heard people book 2 week trips and then they think, oh my gosh, this is way too long. Is there an ideal length of time to go on safari?
I've been on a 3 day safari, a 1 week safari, and a 1 month safari. That was a little long, but it really depends on how much you love animals. But I think at least a week.
And you've eaten all over the world. When you think of amazing food on the cheap, which places come right to mind for you?
Thailand, immediately, first answer. Mexico, second answer. Just incredible culinary traditions there with amazing food. Oh, Vietnam, too.
Right. Okay. Well, before we let you go, what advice do you have to people who are on the fence about booking a trip?
Life is short, and at the end, you won't remember all that extra time in the office, but you will remember that amazing safari you decided to YOLO and go for 2 weeks.
All right. Well, we've been talking to Matt Kettness, better known as Nomadic Matt, the travel expert and author of the best-selling book, How to Travel the World on $75 a Day. Well, thanks so much for joining us on State of the Bay, Matt.
Well, thanks for having me. I love talking travel, so thank you.
All right. Well, you can find Matt's tips, travel guides, and blog at nomadicmatt.com and on our website.
Well, that was Ann Harper talking to Matt Kepnes. Hard to listen to that interview and not want to pack your bags if you are a traveler at heart. Wonderful tips there. And that is our show. That's State of the Bay for this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6, where we'll examine how the Trump administration is cutting funding for the National Endowment for the Arts and how that is impacting our local arts organizations here in the Bay Area. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen, and you'll never miss an episode. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on KALW.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. You can email us anytime at stateofthebay@KALW.org. Tonight's show was produced by Katie Colley and Ann Harper. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. Coming up next is a rebroadcast of Your Call, hosted by yours truly earlier today. I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening.